Now, over a black and white photograph, a title reads, Brooklyn. We glide over a crowded 19th century city toward a slender white church steeple, which rises high above the jumble of factories, houses, and brownstones that line the narrow streets.
Brooklyn Eagle, 1846. In our sundown perambulations of late, through the outer parts of Brooklyn, we have observed several parties of youngsters playing bass, a certain game of ball.
A boy in knickers swings a bat.
Let us go forth a while and get better air in our lungs. Let us leave our close rooms. The game of ball is glorious. Walt Whitman.
Now, in grainy black and white footage, we zigzag along metal tracks through a cavernous train station. We emerge into sunlight and head toward the Brooklyn Bridge.
In 1909, a man named Charles Hercules Ebbets began secretly buying up adjacent parcels of land in the Flatbush section of Brooklyn, including the site of a garbage dump called Pigtown, because of the pigs that once ate their fill there and the stench that still filled the air. He hoped eventually to build a permanent home for the lackluster baseball team he had once worked for and now owned. The team was called the Trolley Dodgers, or just the Dodgers, after the way their devoted fans negotiated Brooklyn's busy streets. In 1912, construction began. By the time it was completed, Pigtown had been transformed into Ebbets Field, baseball's newest shrine, where some of the game's greatest drama would take place. In the years to come, Dodger fans would see more bad times than good, but hardly care. Listen to the southern cadences of a pioneer broadcaster and witness firsthand baseball's finest moment, when a black man wearing the number 42 trotted out to first base.
A young, strong-browed Jackie Robinson fidgets in front of the camera. Now Ebbets Field lies in a heap of rubble.
In 1955, after more than four decades of frustration, Brooklyn would finally win a world championship, only to know just 2 years later the ultimate heartbreak as their team moved to a new city 3,000 miles away, leaving an empty shell in Flatbush and an even emptier spot in the soul of every Brooklyn fan.
A title appears, a Florentine Films production. Now, as dusk settles over modern-day Boston, we fly toward the bright green diamond of Fenway Park.
Fenway Park as Ted Williams hits probably for the last time in a Boston uniform in this ballpark. There's a drive to deep right center. This may be gone. Brad way back there watching. Oh, good! Ted Williams!
Edlander winds and fires. Yastrzemski lines a base hit into center field. Adair's around second. He will score. It's tied 2-2.
The 1-0 delivery to Fisk. He swings. Long drive. Left field. If it stays fair, it's gone. Home run! The Red Sox win. And the series is tied 3 games apiece.
Broadcaster Bob Costas.
First thing about it, and this seems so obvious that maybe we overlook it, baseball is a beautiful thing. It's more beautiful in an old park that's asymmetrical and quirky. But even, and I hate to say this because it might encourage them, but even in a dome with artificial turf, it's beautiful. The way the field fans out, the choreography of the sport, the pace and rhythm of it, the fact that that pace and rhythm allows for conversation and reflection and opinion and comparison.
It's a pastime, something you do. It's entertainment, something you watch. And it's a shared experience, something you talk about and read about.
Robert Creamer.
And that's marvelous. But you can apply those same three criteria to other things. What makes baseball special is that it's the best game that's ever been devised.
In a black and white photo, a man's right hand holds a baseball with his index and middle fingers lined up between the stitches.
It measures just 9 inches in circumference, weighs only about 5 ounces and is made of cork wound with woolen yarn, covered with 2 layers of cowhide, and stitched by hand precisely 216 times. It travels 60 feet 6 inches from the pitcher's mound to home, and it can cover that distance at nearly 100 miles an hour. Along the way, it can be made to twist, spin, curve, wobble, rise, or fall away.
Honus Wagner examines a bat.
The bat is made of turned ash, less than 42 inches long, not more than 2 3/4 inches in diameter. The batter has only a few thousandths of a second to decide to hit the ball.
A young, solemn-faced Lou Gehrig in a Columbia uniform.
And yet the men who fail 7 times out of 10 are considered the game's greatest heroes.
Now, bordered by red and blue stripes, a white title appears, baseball. Now, a faded black and white photograph. A sea of fans, mostly men in derbies and top hats, fills the seats of an old stadium, Boston's South End grounds. The Boston open air seats form a semicircle around the field, with an airy 2-story grandstand rising up behind home plate. On the roof, banners wave from several graceful cone-shaped spires that stand at the corners. The players, wearing baggy white flannel uniforms, caps, and dark socks, stand in the middle of the worn grassy field, facing an American flag. A man in the stands glances at us over his shoulder, with wide, curious eyes and a bushy mustache. Our view glides out over the baseball diamond, 2 stories below. Now, 6 grinning boys wearing knickers and floppy caps grab the handle of a wooden bat, piling their hands one over the other.
It is played everywhere. In parks and playgrounds and prison yards. In back alleys and farmers' fields. By small boys and old men. Raw amateurs and millionaire professionals. It is a leisurely game that demands blinding speed.
A runner slides head first.
The only game in which the defense has the ball.
A fielder tags the runner's arm with his glove.
It follows the seasons, beginning each year with the fond expectancy of springtime and ending with the hard facts of autumn.
Farmers play in a cut field, and a team of workmen poses in front of an American flag.
Americans have played baseball for more than 200 years. While they conquered a continent, warred with one another and with enemies abroad, struggled over labor and civil rights and the meaning of freedom.
Actor Billy Crystal.
It's the game my father taught me how to play. It's time I saw things on a level plane, something was rolling towards me. And it said Spalding on it. I picked it up. Instinctually, we push it back. And those days, those summer days became fall days, became our Sundays together with my brothers and I, and my dad whipping off his wicked curve. And I just remember how my hands hurt. At first, as I was afraid of the ball and his coaching, you know, keep your shoulder in there, don't bail out, it's not gonna hurt you, you know? And that's what I remember.
On a farm, 4 children play an improvised game in their bare feet.
At its heart lie mythic contradictions. A pastoral game born in crowded cities. An exhilarating democratic sport that tolerates cheating and has excluded as many as it has included. A profoundly conservative game that often manages to be years ahead of its time.
A young black player poses with his white teammates. Their uniforms read, Adrian. Now, people gather around a diamond neatly cut into the grass of a town green.
It is an American odyssey that links sons and daughters to fathers and grandfathers. And it reflects a host of age-old American tensions between workers and owners, scandal and reform, the individual and the collective.
The scene shifts to a black and white photo of a ball field. From behind home plate, we look through the wire mesh of a backstop while the pitcher starts his windup.
It is a haunted game in which every player is measured against the ghosts of all who have gone before. Most of all, it is about time and timelessness.
Carlton Fisk.
Speed and grace.
A base runner leaps.
Failure and loss.
A dejected coach.
Imperishable hope.
Excited fans.
And coming home.
A runner scores.
Here's a pitch, it's a slow curve low, and the Babe swings. It's a long one, it's in there. Another home run for the Bambino.
The burly Babe Ruth trots around the bases.
Feller starts that wind up. Here's the pitch for the second strike. Here's the pitch. Swings on a low fastball for strike three.
And now comes up Joe DiMaggio. He connects, a long ball going out into left field. Medwick's under it, but it's a home run.
The handsome, rangy DiMaggio watches the ball leave the park.
Robinson with a good lead. There he goes.
Jackie Robinson steals.
He hits the dirt and he's safe. Paso pitches. Williams swings. There's a high drive. It is a home run.
Ted Williams claps excitedly.
The 2-2 to May. The swing ground ball, third base side. Brooks Robinson's got it. Throwing from foul ground toward first base.
Robinson makes a long throw.
It is in time.
It's fun. That's what it is. It's fun. Baseball is more fun than anything else. You can watch it and just love it. You enjoy it. I don't think there's anything tremendously philosophical about it. I don't think there's anything metaphysical. I just think it's so much fun to watch. You watch a player do something. You watch a second baseman go up in the air in a double play, and he throws the ball, and he's like a bird in flight, and he's watching to see what happened. You see a first baseman take a bad throw in the dirt and come up with something like that and sort of wander off the bag as if there's no problem at all. It's just delightful.
Willie Mays chases a deep fly and makes a basket catch with his back to the ball.
Willie Mays just brought this crowd to his feet with a catch, which must have been an optical illusion to a lot of people.
It looks easy.
Historian John Thorne.
When you see ball players at the stadium or on television catching a fly ball, it seems this is what we did when we were kids. It's really, we could be down there. There isn't that much separating me from Bo Jackson or George Brett. I could be there. I could do that. You have the illusion. Baseball fosters illusions. Baseball fosters hopes. Baseball inflates us. Baseball lies to us seductively, and we know we're being seduced, and we don't complain.
Now, in a black and white photograph, kids in caps and overalls play a pickup game in a narrow alley between tall tenement buildings. Laundry hung out to dry forms a billowing canopy over their heads.
The game's greatest figures have come from everywhere. Coal mines and college campuses, city slums and country crossroads.
John McGraw.
A brawling Irish immigrant son who for more than half a century preached a rough, scrambling brand of baseball in which anything went so long as victory was won.
Christy Mathewson.
And his favorite player, a college-educated right-hander so uniformly virtuous that millions of schoolboys worshipped him as the Christian gentleman.
Shoeless Joe Jackson.
A millhand who could neither read nor write and who might have been one of the game's greatest heroes if temptation had not proved too great.
The grim-faced Kennesaw Mountain Landis.
And a flamboyant federal judge who first helped save baseball from a scandal that threatened to destroy it, and then became an implacable enemy of reform.
His muscular legs stepping forward, Mickey Mantle finishes a mighty left-handed swing.
A miner's son from Commerce, Oklahoma, who made himself the game's most powerful switch hitter despite 17 seasons of ceaseless pain.
Branch Rickey.
And a tight-fisted Methodist. A cross, one sports writer said, between a statistician and an evangelist, who profoundly changed the game twice.
Satchel Paige.
And there were those whose true greatness was never fully measured because of the stubborn prejudice that permeated both the nation and its favorite game.
A young, lean Ty Cobb.
Two of baseball's best began life in rural Georgia, a swift, savage competitor who may have been the greatest player of all time, but whose uncontrollable rage in the end made him more enemies than friends.
Jackie Robinson.
And another no less fierce competitor who, because he managed to hold his temper, made professional baseball a truly national pastime more than a century after it was born.
The round-faced, coarse-featured Babe Ruth.
And then there was the Baltimore saloon keeper's turbulent son, who became the best-known and best-loved athlete in American history.
Writer Gerald Early.
I enjoy the game because it's a beautifully designed game. It's a beautiful game to watch. But principally because it makes me feel American. It makes me feel connected with this culture. And I think there are only three things that America will be known for 2,000 years from now when they study this civilization: the Constitution, jazz music, and baseball. They're the three most beautifully designed things this culture has ever produced.
In a faded photo, men in baggy trousers play in front of a house.
I see great things in baseball. It's our game, the American game.
Women in long hoop skirts look on.
It will take our people out of doors, fill them with oxygen, give them a larger physical stoicism, tend to relieve us from being a nervous, dyspeptic set.
A fiddle band plays behind them.
Repair these losses and be a blessing to us. Walt Whitman.
Fade to black. In white letters on a black background, titles read, First Inning, Our Game. Now, over the grassy banks of a misty lake, another title appears, Cooperstown. The sky glows reddish gold in the fading light of dusk. Our view glides over figures in a tree grove on shore, standing and moving in dark silhouette. A woman in a floppy straw hat and long dress, men in top hats and derbies. A tall boy holds out his hands to catch a ball, while several feet in front of him, a batter takes a few relaxed practice swings.
One summer day in 1839 at Cooperstown, New York, on the shores of Lake Otsego, the local academy was playing a game of town ball against Green's select school.
He swings. A runner crosses home plate.
The rules of town ball were so loose that every hit was fair, and boys sometimes ran headlong into one another.
The runners sprint around trees.
That day, an academy player named Abner Doubleday sat down and on the spot drew up the rules for a brand new game and called it baseball. Abner Doubleday would eventually become a hero at the Battle of Gettysburg, and his game would become the national pastime, or so the legend has it.
The figures gradually fade, then vanish.
Abner Doubleday really was a distinguished soldier, but he was at West Point, not Cooperstown, that summer. Never claimed to have had anything to do with baseball. May never have even seen a professional game. Baseball's real history is more complicated.
Baseball has nearly all the qualities and the narrative that the country has.
It's competitive. It's spirited. It's got the joshing, and it's got the intellectual side, the great students of it. It's also got labor unions and management and gimmicks and promotion and venality and great public fools in baseball and great public heroes and self-serving people and generous people.
And it has pride and unity of town and of country, and it'll do for a figure for the American system.
Journalist Charlie McDowell. Now, in an oil painting, a rosy-cheeked little boy holds a brown ball and wooden bat.
1744. The ball once struck off, away flies the boy to the next destined post, and then home with joy.
A faded photo of boys in flat woolen caps.
Children have hit balls with bats as long as there have been children. But baseball's most direct ancestors were two British games. Rounders, a children's sport brought to New England by the earliest colonists, and cricket, a stately pastime divided into innings and supervised by umpires. By the time of the American Revolution, there were many variations. Boys played one version or another in schoolyards and village greens and on college campuses.
1786. A fine day. Play ball in the campus, but am beaten, for I miss catching and striking the ball. Princeton College.
Of all baseball's ancestors, town ball was by far the most popular. Under its rules, the infield was square. 8 to 15 men played on a side, sometimes as many as 50. The pitcher or feeder was the least important player. It was his job to lob the ball to the striker, who could wait and wait for the pitch he wanted. The runner was out if the ball was caught on the fly, or if he was soaked, hit with the ball while running between bases. By 1800, town ball and its many variations were played nearly everywhere. On their way back from the Pacific Ocean, Lewis and Clark played a game of base with the Nez Perce Indians as they prepared to cross the Bitterroot Mountains. In the 1830s, on the western frontier of Missouri, ball was the favorite sport of Joseph Smith, the founder of a new religious sect called the Mormons. But back east in Cooperstown, New York, city fathers passed an ordinance restricting play after merchants complained about too many broken windows. Meanwhile, in New York City, they were starting to play a brand new version of the game.
A photo of 19th century Cooperstown fades to black. A title reads Elysian Fields. Writer Roger Angel.
There is the illusion that this connects us on a straight line to our rural past, our country past. And we have an image somewhere in the back of our minds of fathers and sons or boys playing baseball on a meadow somewhere. The truth of the matter is that baseball was an urban game almost from the beginning. Organized ball was played by men in cities near saloons.
In the 1840s, New Yorkers walked and worked and lived at what was called a railroad pace. For the thousands of single men pouring into the city in search of work, their crowded world centered around boarding houses and saloons, volunteer fire companies and ward politics, and baseball teams. In September of 1845, as Americans now claimed the right to overspread the whole of the continent, a group of friends formed the New York Knickerbocker Baseball Club. They were merchants, brokers, insurance salesmen, a United States Marshal, a portrait photographer, a dealer in cigars. And they showed a lively interest in improving the game.
Three balls being struck at and missed, and the last one caught is a hand out. If not caught, is considered fair, and the striker bound to run. Alexander Joy Cartwright.
Alexander Joy Cartwright was a volunteer fireman and bank clerk working for Daniel Ebbets, the father of the man who would one day build Ebbets Field. He helped establish the Knickerbockers and codify new rules that would change the game forever. The infield would now be diamond-shaped. Foul lines were established, and the batter got three missed swings before he was called out. Most important, runners would now be tagged or thrown out, not thrown at. It was now a more challenging game, faster paced, American, and to the Knickerbockers' great delight, quite distinct from cricket and rounders.
Club members pose for a team photo.
But there was precious little room to play the new game in the crowded streets of Lower Manhattan, and the Knickerbockers had to travel across the Hudson River to Hoboken, New Jersey, and a grassy area called the Elysian Fields.
A painting of a diamond in a riverside park.
They crossed the Barclay Street ferry in a body, like unto the pilgrims of yore, and marched up the country road on the Jersey side, prospecting here and there for suitable grounds, until they reached the Elysian Fields, where they settled. Then they perfected their organization, calling it the Knickerbockers, which was the nucleus of the great American game of baseball. Seymour Church.
Twice a week we went over to the Elysian Fields for practice. Once there, we were free from all restraint, and throwing off our coats, we played until it was too dark to see any longer. I was a left-handed batter and sometimes used to hit the ball into the river. People began to take an interest in the game presently, and sometimes we had as many as 100 spectators watching.
A hitter, his hands far apart on the bat.
By the following spring, the Knickerbockers were finally ready to take on another team. On June 19, 1846, at the Elysian Fields, they played against a group of cricket players in the first real baseball game in history. The Knickerbockers lost 23-1, but their game spread throughout the city. By the 1850s, New York was baseball mad.
A series of faded black and white team photos, dark-skinned men in cloth caps and others in white shirts and baggy black pants. One player wears a t-shirt while his teammate sports a black ribbon bow tie. Another group wears crisp sailor suits. Many have bushy sideburns and wield heavy, thick-handled bats.
There were teams of doctors, teams of teachers, teams of tradesmen. Shipbuilders formed clubs, so did firemen, bankers, teamsters, lawyers, even undertakers.
A team dressed in all white with black belts that read Mutual.
Meanwhile, the Knickerbockers continued to refine their game. The winning team was the first to get 21 aces, or runs, soon changed to whoever was ahead at the end of 9 innings. They standardized the number of men who could play on a side at 9. And set the bases 90 feet apart.
Charlie McDowell.
That's so interesting that it would come out 90 feet. That somebody sat down, Mr. Cartwright or whoever, and said, hey, it ought to be 90 feet. It just sounded like a logical number. The fact of the matter is, in retrospect, if it were 88 feet, the game would be very different. Think of the plays at first base. Think of the double plays that wouldn't be completed on an 88-foot first base. And second base. If it were 94 feet, we'd be throwing people out all over the place. Batting averages would drop remarkably. So if 90 feet was something somebody said, hey, that's a good number, that was a pick from heaven.
Now, in a village with new wooden buildings, men wearing baggy suits and derbies watch a boy run toward home plate.
Alexander Joy Cartwright left Manhattan and helped spread baseball westward, across the Rockies, onto the California Gold Rush, then all the way to Hawaii. There, he became a wealthy merchant, but he never entirely lost interest in the team he'd helped to form or the game he'd helped lay out.
Honolulu. Dear old Knickerbockers, I hope the club is still kept up. And I shall someday meet again with them on the pleasant fields of Hoboken. Have in my possession the original ball with which we used to play on Murray Hill. Sometimes I have thought of sending it home, but I cannot bear to part with it. So linked in with cherished home memories.
A photo of the pensive, dark-eyed, bearded Cartwright fades to black. Buck O'Neill, Kansas City Monarchs.
It is the American game. That's just what it is. Actually, it makes you me. I'm 81, but I can feel like I'm 15 when I'm talking baseball. I'm watching baseball. This is it. It does this. It can do this to any man. It brings you back.
A title appears, A People's Game. In a photo, men in dark suits take turns batting while others lounge on the grass.
It may be truly said that the year of 1856 was the birth year of the evolution of baseball. It was then that we took note of the possibilities of the game and saw in it a lever which could be advantageously used to lift up athletic sports into a desired popularity. Henry Chadwick.
A graying, bearded man.
In 1856, a British-born music teacher and enthusiastic cricketer named Henry Chadwick saw the Knickerbockers play the New York Gothams and became an instant convert to baseball.
Americans do not care to dawdle over a sleep-inspiring game all through the heat of a June or July day. What they want to do in a hurry. In baseball, all is lightning. Thus, the reason for the American antipathy to cricket can readily be understood.
Chadwick developed the box score, wrote and edited the most popular player's manual, and launched one of the first baseball columns, covering the Knickerbockers and their challengers, the Gothams, Eagles, Empires, Excelsiors, and Atlantics, in the pages of the New York Clipper. And he began keeping comparative statistics so that he could measure one player's performance against another's.
Editor Daniel Okrent.
Because we've been playing it fundamentally the same way for so long, the way that we can find the benchmarks that cross generations and cross decades is to be able to use these statistics as if they were labels. They aren't numbers. 300 hitter is not a number. The 300 hitter is a tag that means something today, as it did in 1930, as it did in 1890. So the statistics become a means by which we can connect to the permanence of this thing. I can make that comparison with my father, who could have made it with his father, on that common language of statistics.
A boy in a gleaming white uniform with a baseball diamond stitched on the shirt.
On December 5th, 1856, the Sunday New York Mercury referred to baseball for the first time, somewhat optimistically, as the national pastime.
Ball playing communicated such an impulse to our limbs and joints that there is nothing now heard of in our leisure hours but ball, ball, ball. I cannot prophesy with any degree of accuracy concerning the continuance of this rage for play, but the effect is good, since there's been a thoroughgoing reformation from inactivity and torpitude. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow.
Posed studio shots of players catching the ball barehanded. Now, horse-drawn buggies ring a fenced-in field.
There were some 50 clubs in the New York area alone by 1858. And special trains ran out to Long Island, where onlookers saw the New York All-Stars beat their Brooklyn counterparts, and for the first time were made to pay for the privilege, 50 cents, to the man who owned the field. In an attempt to keep control of their game, the Knickerbockers and other established clubs banded together to form the National Association of Baseball Players. They set down still more rules. An umpire was given the power to call strikes. No one was allowed to catch the ball in his cap. Above all, baseball was to remain an amateur's game. No player was ever to be paid.
The players wear uniforms with the word National stitched on the waistband.
By the spring of 1861, there were 62 member clubs in the National Association of Baseball Players. Free blacks in northern cities had established their own teams. And Henry Chadwick was trying to start a baseball club in Richmond, Virginia, when the new season was suddenly interrupted.
In a photo, we overlook an army camp with dozens of tents strewn across a smoking field.
Virginia, April 3rd, 1862. It is astonishing how indifferent a person can become to danger. The report of musketry is heard but a very little distance from us. Yet over there on the other side of the road is most of our company playing bat ball. And perhaps in less than half an hour, they may be called to play a ball game of a more serious nature. Frederick Fairfax, 5th Ohio Infantry.
Grizzled, bearded soldiers sit around an outdoor table, reading, writing, and sewing.
Soldiers in both armies played ball whenever and wherever they could. Just like boys, one of them remembered.
A series of black and white photographs. Soldiers in flat-topped kepi caps lounge in the grass, sleeves rolled up. One holds a long, thick bat. Union soldiers pose for the camera with rifles in their arms and bats piled in front of them. A group of somber-faced men, all wearing dark jackets with gleaming metal buttons. One mustached soldier clutches a bat and a ball.
If there was any transforming incident in the history of baseball, as in the history of this country, it was the Civil War. Play in the 1840s and 50s was not for the middle class. It was not for the working class. It was reserved for so-called gentlemen. Play became democratic when it became portable. It became a people's game.
We were playing ball between the lines near Alexandria, Texas, when suddenly there came a scattering fire of which the three outfielders caught the brunt. The center field was hit and was captured. The left and right field managed to get back into our lines. The rebel attack was repelled without serious difficulty. But we had lost not only our center field, but the only baseball in Alexandria, Texas.
Now a headline reads, Andersonville, how our soldiers were murdered there, another illustration of, quote, Southern chivalry. In a neighboring column, another headline appears. Baseball, great match for the championship of the United States. The Atlantic Club of Brooklyn, the winners. The finest display of the season.
A long winter's idleness and lack of practice were evident. With the war being over, it is hoped that there will be a renewal of interest in our own purely national game. Buffalo Express.
A rosy-cheeked soldier leans on his rifle.
By the end of the Civil War, baseball was the national pastime. North and South, West as well as East. Soldiers took the game home with them, and it grew.
Players take their positions on a diamond carved into a village green.
It's our game. That's the chief fact in connection with it. America's game has the snap, go, fling of the American atmosphere. It belongs as much to our institutions, fits into them as significantly as our Constitution's laws, is just as important in the sum total of our historic life. Walt Whitman.
Walking paths cut across the playing field, dividing it into irregular swatches of grass. A dirt path connects the pitcher's mound to home plate. Mario Cuomo, governor of New York.
There's so much about the game that appeals to the intellect and to the psyche. The symmetry of it, the orderliness of it, the justice of it. The fact that it throws off other controls, it's greater than time strictures. You know, in the other sports, you have time, you have to play against the clock. And when the clock runs out, your chance is over. No clock in baseball. You play until you lose. And if you can keep that rally alive, if you can keep going, if you can keep getting hits, you can play until a week from now. Nothing stops you. There is no parameter that makes it impossible for you to perform still more excellently.
A new title, Division of Feeling. A close-up of a man's hand holding a grimy baseball with crooked stitches.
In October 1867, as federal troops enforced civil rights laws in the South, the African American Pythian Baseball Club of Philadelphia applied for membership in the Pennsylvania Association of Baseball Players. They were turned away. 2 months later, the National Association took up the issue.
If colored clubs were admitted, there would in all probability be some division of feeling. Whereas by excluding them, no injury could result to anyone.
Despite the ban, the Pythians became the first recorded all-black team to play a white team, the Philadelphia City Items, a group of newspaper men. The Pythians won 27-17. Their captain, Octavius Cato, was later killed in a Philadelphia race riot that started when blacks attempted to exercise their right to vote.
In a faded photo, young women in long skirts and high-necked blouses carry bats.
The public, so far as it knew of our playing, was shocked. But in our retired grounds, we continued to play in spite of a censorious public.
In 1866, at Vassar College, a group of freshmen, with the support of a female physician who thought exercise for women essential to good health, formed the Laurel and Abenakis Baseball Club. Other colleges soon followed suit.
They are getting up various clubs now for out-of-door exercise. They have a floral society, boat clubs, and baseball clubs. I belong to one of the latter, and enjoy it highly, I can assure you. Annie Glidden.
They did not play for long.
One day, a student, while running between bases, fell with an injured leg. We attended her to the infirmary with the foreboding that this accident would end our play of baseball. Dr. Webster said that the public doubtless would condemn the game as too violent, but that if the student had hurt herself while dancing, the public would not condemn dancing to extinction. Sophia Richardson.
Some wear striped caps, others have initials on the brim.
The teams were soon forced to disband. The game was considered far too violent for young ladies to play.
One woman reads a rule book with a sly grin. Thomas Boswell, sports writer.
Americans have always had a wonderful aversion to excesses of honesty. And baseball has always been able to express that. The sense in baseball is that the reason they put those four umpires out there is to enforce the rules. But if you can get outside the rules and outside the umpires, it is a very reasonable question to ask whether you might not be allowed to do it.
One afternoon on the Brooklyn waterfront, a boy named William Cummings, known to his friends as Candy, noticed that he could make a clamshell curve when he hurled it through the air, and began to wonder if he might be able to do the same thing one day with a baseball. In April 1867, now pitching for the Brooklyn Excelsiors, Candy Cummings tried out his new pitch.
I began to watch the flight of the ball through the air and distinctly saw it curve. A surge of joy flooded over me that I shall never forget. I said not a word, saw many a batter at that game throw down his stick in disgust. Every time I was successful, I could scarcely keep from dancing for pure joy. The secret was mine. Candy Cummings.
Cummings' secret did not remain his for long. Though it was outlawed, everyone started throwing the curveball. Purists were appalled.
I heard that this year we at Harvard won the baseball championship because we have a pitcher who has a fine curveball. I am further instructed that the purpose of the curveball is to deliberately deceive the batter. Harvard is not in the business of teaching deception. Charles Eliot, president of Harvard College.
Harvard players pose languidly around a classical pillar.
January 9th, 1868. Somehow or other, they don't play ball nowadays as they used to some 8 or 10 years ago. I don't mean to say that they don't play it as well, but I mean that they don't play with the same kind of feelings or for the same objects they used to. It appears to me that ball matches have come to be controlled by different parties and for different purposes than those that prevailed in 1858 or 1859. Pete O'Brien.
A team of older, gray-bearded men. A new title, Baseball is Business Now. An improvised playing field at the intersection of two dirt roads.
What must be the contempt for those who would degrade our great national game and make it a business? When such becomes the case, farewell to baseball. The excitement which is at present attendant on these contests will cease. Then the game itself will gradually but surely die out. Philadelphia City Item.
Fans watch a game from behind a tall chicken wire fence.
The public will happily pay 75 cents to $1.50 to go to the theater. And numbers prefer baseball to theatricals. We must make the games worth witnessing, and there will be no fault found with the price. A good game is worth 50 cents. A poor one is dear at 25. Harry Wright.
A man in a uniform emblazoned with the letter C.
Harry Wright eats baseball, breathes baseball, thinks baseball, dreams baseball, and incorporates baseball in his prayers. Cincinnati Enquirer.
Harry Wright, a former center fielder for the Knickerbocker Baseball Club, believed there were big profits to be made in baseball. And in 1869, he assembled the very first professional team, the Cincinnati Red Stockings. Only one of Wright's Red Stockings actually came from Cincinnati. Most were young New Yorkers, 19 or 20 years old. Wright drilled them in the fundamentals, insisted they be silent and businesslike on the field, and dressed them in knickers to boost their running speed.
The players wear ankle-high boots and tight socks.
And for the first time, to the shock of the baseball community, he paid each player a salary. The highest paid was Harry's brother George, the shortstop, who received a considerable sum of $1,400 a season, 7 times the average working man's wage.
Now the Red Stockings practice in a two-story stadium with a gabled roof.
The Red Stockings finished their first season with a record of 65 wins and not a single loss. They also managed to turn a profit for their investors, $1.39. The city that had once prided itself on the stockyards, which inspired its nickname, Porkopolis, had become the baseball capital of the country. And the Red Stockings spread the gospel from New York to San Francisco, traveling on the just-completed Transcontinental Railroad.
Every magnate in the country is indebted to this man, Harry Wright, for the establishment of baseball as a business, and every patron for furnishing him with a systematic recreation. Every player is indebted to him for inaugurating an occupation by which he gains a livelihood, and the country at large for adding one more industry to furnish employment. Sporting life.
The Red Stockings seemed unbeatable. They won 27 straight the next season, too. And then they came to the Capitol Line grounds in Brooklyn to face the Atlantics, the best team in the East, and the toughest. Before 20,000 paying spectators, Cincinnati and Brooklyn fought to a 5-5 tie over 9 innings. It was the most exciting game anyone could ever remember. Under the rules, Harry Wright could have settled for a tie, but he decided to risk his record and try something new, extra innings. At first, the gamble seemed to pay off. Cincinnati scored 2 runs in the top of the 11th.
But then, with two Atlantics on base, the Cincinnati first baseman, Charles Gould, made a bad throw. By the time it was all over, Brooklyn scored three runs, and Cincinnati had been beaten.
Wearing his uniform, Wright crosses his arms and frowns somberly.
June 14th. Telegram to the Cincinnati Commercial. Atlantic's 8, Cincinnati's 7. The finest game ever played. Our boys did nobly, but fortune was against us. Though beaten, not disgraced. Harry Wright.
Fans stare glumly at the team.
Cincinnati was devastated. With their winning streak over, fans stopped going to Red Stockings games. Investors withdrew their support, complaining that with attendance down, the players' salary demands were unreasonable.
We scan the players' grim faces.
Finally, the team was disbanded.
A photo of an older Wright with a salt and pepper beard.
Harry Wright moved on. At the invitation of a band of New England promoters, he took the best of his Red Stockings to Boston, where they became the most successful team in the country. By moving his stars from city to city, the Sporting Times later said, Wright had set new prices on their muscle.
Baseball is business now, and I'm trying to arrange our games to make them successful and make them pay. Irrespective of my feelings and to the best of my ability, if I should fail, that I will try and do better next time. Harry Wright.
For the professional teams and leagues that now sprung up all across the country, winning and the profits it promised was fast becoming the most important thing.
Men play in a muddy field.
But outside the big cities, baseball remained a game, not a business.
When we heard of a professional game in which men cared nothing whatever for patriotism but only for money, games in which rival towns would hire the best players from a natural enemy, we could scarcely believe the tale was true. No kinsman boy would any more give aid and comfort to a rival town than would a loyal soldier open a gate in the wall and let an enemy march in. Clarence Darrow, Kinsman, Ohio.
Now, infielders tense as a batter prepares to swing.
August 10th, 1874. I was catcher for the Hartfords, and Cherokee Fisher was pitching. He is a lightning pitcher, and very few could catch for him. On that occasion, he delivered as wicked a ball as ever left his hands, and it went through my grasp like an express train, striking me with full force inside. I fell insensible to the ground, but was quickly picked up, placed in a carriage, and driven to my hotel. The doctor who attended me gave me a hypodermic injection of morphine, but I had rather died behind the bat than have had that first dose. My injury was only temporary, but from taking prescriptions of morphine during my illness, the habit grew on me, and I am now powerless in its grasp. My morphine pleasure has cost me $8 a day, at least. I was once catcher for the Mutuals, also for the Atlantics, but no one would think it to look at me now. Tom Barlow, Hartford Hartfords.
In a close-up, a man's hand grips a baseball between the seams, ready to throw a pitch. Fade to black. A title appears, the National League. Now, in a team photo, players wear uniforms lettered NY.
The aim of baseball is to employ professional players to perspire in public for the benefit of gamblers. The New York Times.
By the mid-1870s, a man could make a good living playing baseball. But some found they could make an even better living throwing games for gamblers. Speculators trading on inside information had taken over much of the professional game, just as they had taken over many other institutions. Cornering the gold market,
ruining the stock market, defrauding the government, creating huge monopolies. As the country approached its centennial celebration, public faith in its national pastime began to fade. Henry Chadwick, who had struggled so hard to promote baseball, now found himself crusading against corruption in the game he loved.
Baseball has fallen. Yes, the national game has become degraded. At certain match games, large amounts of money changed hands among the spectatory. A noted New York club is said to have sold the results of a match. Barked chins and broken fingers may be easily mended, but a disfigured reputation may never be entirely repaired. Once more, abandon the bat, boys, if you cannot keep the game pure.
An elegant nine-story building dominates a street.
On February 2nd, 1876, at Manhattan's Grand Central Hotel, a group of club owners, eager to tighten their control of the game, restore its respectability, and most of all to ensure greater profits, started a new association. They called it the National League of Professional Baseball Clubs.
It is ridiculous to pay ballplayers $2,000 a year, especially when the $800 boys often do just as well. William Hulbert.
William A. Hulbert, a ruthless coal magnate who owned the Chicago White Stockings, became the National League's president. He immediately took steps to revive the reputation of the professional game. Players were forbidden to drink on the field or off. No beer was to be served on the grounds. Gambling was barred. Ticket prices were set at 50 cents, and no games were to be played on Sundays. Above all, power was to be invested in the owners, not the players.
Editor Daniel Okrent.
It's not that the owners came in for entirely bad reasons. There were, you know, the questions about gambling in the game and other seedy aspects of it. They wanted to clean it up, but that's as much a historical cover story as it was a reality. Like all good American businessmen, they saw an opportunity.
Three rows of Cincinnati Red Stockings.
To further solidify their control, the owners added a reserve clause to the contracts of the five best men on every team. It required that each play only for his current employer and reserved his services for the following year. At first, few complained. To be reserved was to be sure of a job for the coming season. Those who did complain that the reserve clause smacked of slavery were fired, then blacklisted.
In Washington, with the Capitol Dome looming in the background, our view glides over a ball field. Billboards on the outfield wall advertise medicines and beer.
For the first time in the history of the game, the players would serve the interests of the owners. For the next 100 years, the professional game would be dominated by those who owned the field and supplied the ball. Players would simply be employees.
Fade to black. Now a title. I Am Dumb, Harry. A man leans over a high wooden wall. Chewing his pen thoughtfully, he looks down at a team in Louisville uniforms on the field just below him.
It is not known whether the players have been dissipating, keeping late hours, and having a jolly time generally. But tight or sober, they should realize the fact that they've run afoul of a most humiliating set of reverses. Louisville Courier-Journal.
After a spectacular early season in 1877, the Louisville Grays of the new National League mysteriously lost seven games in a row. Players bobbled the ball, seemed to slow between bases, swung suspiciously wide. The Grays lost the pennant. Afterwards, some were seen wearing fancy clothes and diamond stick pins. An investigation revealed that gamblers had bought off four players, including one of the National League's greatest pitchers, the popular Jim Devlin. When confronted with the evidence, Devlin confessed.
was introduced to a man named McLeod, who said when I wanted to make a little money to let him know. Was to use the word sash in telegraphing, and he would know what was meant. We made a contract to throw a game in Indianapolis. Received $100 from McLeod for it. And gave it to my wife.
The magnitude of the conspiracy stunned the baseball world. The Louisville Grays suspended the accused players, who claimed they had only done it because their owners had failed to pay them their wages. Devlin was brought before National League President William Hulbert.
Devlin was in tears. Hulbert was in tears. I saw Hulbert take a $50 bill and press it into the palm of the prostrate player. And then I heard him say, "That's what I think of you personally. But damn you, Devlin, you are dishonest. You have sold a game, and I can't trust you. Now go and let me never see your face again, for your act will not be condoned so long as I live." Albert Goodwill Spaulding.
Despite their pleas for forgiveness, Hulbert banned all four players from baseball forever. For 5 years, Jim Devlin haunted the corridors outside meetings of the National League club owners, hoping somehow to be reinstated. Desperate, he wrote to Harry Wright, still the most respected man in the game.
"Mr. Harry Wright, dear sir, as I am deprived from playing this year, I thought I would write you to see if you could do anything for me in the way of looking after your ground or anything in the way of work. I don't know what I'm to do. I can assure you, Harry, that I was not treated right. I am honest, Harry. You need not be afraid. The Louisville people made me what I am today, a beggar. I have not got a stitch of clothing, or has my wife and child. I am dumb, Harry. I don't know how to go about it, so I trust you will answer this and do all you can for me. So I still close by sending you and George and all the boys my very best wishes, hoping to hear from you soon. I am yours truly, James A. Devlin."
Harry Wright did nothing.
Fans perch on a billboard to watch a game.
Devlin got a job as a policeman in 1880. But died of consumption just 3 years later. His early death, said a Louisville newspaper, was an instructive example of the fruits of crookedness. The National League had survived its first scandal.
The scene fades to black. A title appears, underlined in red on a black background. Bottom of the first. Writer George Plimpton.
Baseball has these absolutely unique sounds. The sounds of spring, of summer. I can remember a shortstop. I don't remember his name now, but I used to pitch, and he used to call out, "Hibby, hibby, 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 hibby." And it would sort of drift out across the fields. You know, the sound of the ball against the bat is absolutely extraordinary. It brings back, I don't know any American male that doesn't hear that in the springtime and get called back to some moment in the past or summer days in the past.
A title reads, "The Wahoos." In a photo, grinning men in knickers and long sleeves line up on a field.
Despite growing professionalism, the pure game survived in thousands of small towns all across the country. Sam Crawford, who would one day become one of the best outfielders in the game, first played on a traveling town team from Wahoo, Nebraska.
I remember when I made my first baseball trip, a bunch of us from around Wahoo made a trip overland in a wagon drawn by a team of horses. I think there were 11 or 12 of us, and we just started out and went from town to town. One of the boys was a cornet player, and when we'd come to a town, he'd whip out that cornet and sound off. People would all come out to see what was going on, and we'd announce that we were the Wahoo team and were ready for the ball game.
Every little town out there on the prairie had its own ball team and ball grounds, and we challenged them all. It wasn't easy to win those games, as you can imagine. Each of those towns had its own umpire, so you really had to go some to win. We were gone 3 or 4 weeks. We'd take up a collection at the games, pass the hat, you know, and that paid our expenses, or some of them anyway. One of the boys was the cook, but all he could cook was round steak. We'd get 12 pounds for a dollar and have a feast. We'd drive along the country roads, and if we came to a stream, we'd go swimming. If we came to an apple orchard, we'd fill up on apples. We'd sleep anywhere, sometimes in a tent, lots of times on the ground, out in the open. If we were near some fairgrounds, we'd slip in there. If we were near a barn, well, Sam Crawford, Wahoo, Nebraska.
Now, grainy photographs of a baseball bat factory. Dozens of unfinished bats lie stacked on carts.
In 1878, more than 8 million bats were sold in the United States. And players often rode to the ball field in painted carriages, singing team songs. Men who were crazy about baseball were called bugs and cranks. Women who shared their excitement were cranklets. Later, they would be called fans, short either for baseball fanciers or fanatics. Everybody had a team. At Orting, Washington, the fats took on the leans.
Teams of fat and skinny players.
In Kansas, crowds watched the Mother Hubbards, men playing in women's clothing.
Mustached men in bonnets.
Under guard at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, Geronimo's Chiricahua Apaches played ball against the U.S. Army and won. Whalers, frozen in at Herschel Island above the Arctic Circle, played too, naming their teams the Hoodlums, Walruses, and Blubbers.
Stout men in undershirts.
At some games, a keg of beer stood just to the side of third base for encouragement. Any man who made it to third was entitled to a dipper full. When the University of Illinois played Northwestern, Illinois rooters fired blanks into the air. Much more convenient than yelling, the campus paper said, and has a better effect on the visiting team. And when the Princeton Tigers beat Yale, their fans roared right onto the field.
Fans look on as 100 male students wearing caps or straw boater hats put their hands on each other's shoulders and dance around the bases in a chain. Historian John Thorne.
It says, I think, that at root, we're children, or we'd like to be. And the best of us keep as much of that childhood with us as we grow into adulthood as we can muster. And the most creative, the most happy, the most fortunate of us are those who don't lose the sense of play. And even after we're past the point of being able to actually play the game with any skill, if we love it, then it's like Peter Pan. We remain boys forever. We don't die.
A new title appears, The Baseball Messiah. Huge ads on an outfield wall proclaim Spalding, Evening Telegram, and Crosscut.
Baseball is the very symbol, the outward and visible expression of the drive and push and rush and struggle of the raging, tearing, booming 19th century. Mark Twain.
In 1882, owners of Midwestern clubs left out of the National League established a league of their own, the American Baseball Association. Its games cost just a quarter. Its teams played on Sundays, and its ballparks sold liquor. The new beer and whiskey league drew bigger, rowdier crowds. The stands filled with working men and immigrants, not the middle-class, native-born fans who followed the National League. It was baseball's heyday. Competition flourished. Play improved. Attendance skyrocketed. And huge wood and iron grandstands were built in all the big cities.
50-foot girders support huge roofs.
the two leagues staged an end-of-the-season championship for fans who could not get enough baseball.
Thousands spill out of the bleachers and stand on the edge of the field.
In 1882, William Hulbert died, and control of the National League and his old team, the Chicago White Stockings, passed to his second-in-command, A.G. Spaulding.
The magnate must be a strong man among strong men. Everything is possible to him who dares. Albert Goodwill Spaulding.
The railroads had Commodore Vanderbilt. Big Steel had Andrew Carnegie. Big Oil, John D. Rockefeller. Baseball had Albert Goodwill Spaulding.
Young Spaulding in a Boston uniform.
He had been the finest pitcher of the 1870s. He learned his baseball from Harry Wright, who had paid him $1,500 a year to pitch for the Boston Red Stockings.
Spaulding has long sideburns and a bushy mustache.
In 1876, he left Boston for Chicago, lured by William Hulbert's offer of a $500 raise and 25% of the gate. But Spaulding had still bigger things in mind. At age 27, he stopped pitching entirely to become a full-time promoter of baseball and himself. With $800 borrowed from his mother, he opened a sporting goods business. Soon, he was manufacturing all the baseballs used in the National League. He then began making bats and uniforms, managing to persuade club owners that each position should have its own distinctive garb. The result was chaos. The team looked like a Dutch bed of tulips, a Chicago sports writer said, and the experiment was quickly abandoned.
In a team photo, each player wears a different color shirt. Now, a pamphlet cover reads, Spaulding's Baseball Guide.
Like other captains of industry, Spaulding crushed or bought out his competitors, becoming the largest sporting goods manufacturer in the country. Spaulding Sporting Goods, its proprietor said, is converting all America to the gospel of exercise.
The package reads, the official Spaulding League ball.
Spaulding ran his team and his empire from the private box he built for himself in Chicago's Congress Street grounds, fitted out with a gong to summon servants and a new invention, a telephone, to keep track of all his enterprises while he watched the game.
A photo of Spaulding with slick hair, a tailored suit, and a walking stick.
Newspapers called him the baseball messiah.
Now, a blurry photo of players warming up on a parched, grassless desert.
Only one continent now remains to be subjugated by the American baseball bat. Australia surrendered after a 3 weeks campaign of great brilliancy. Asia was met and overcome at Colombo. Africa sent her forces up the Nile, only to be overcome and brought to terms in the shadow of the Great Pyramid.
At the end of the 1888 season, Spaulding led his White Stockings and a pickup team of all-stars on a round-the-world tour to spread the gospel of the great American game.
They pose on the Sphinx.
We are up at breakfast early, as we are to start at 10 o'clock for the pyramids. Camels and donkeys have been secured for the party. The ball players in uniform, as for the first time, the Sphinx is to witness a game of baseball. After lunch, we have photos taken at the Sphinx, and then proceed to play our historical game of ball with about 200 Arabs for an audience. They took more interest in the game than the average Englishman, and did not once refer to it as the old game of rounders, you know.
In a drawing, a game takes place in front of a sprawling estate.
In March, the tour arrived in England.
The verdict of the spectators is almost universally against it, as a competitor with our national game. And in our own individual judgment, it has so many inherent defects that it has not the slightest pretensions to be considered superior to, even if it is equal with, our own juvenile amusement, rounders. on the basis of which it has been modeled.
Now an elegant five-story building.
When the tour got back to New York, there was a banquet served in 9 innings at Delmonico's. Theodore Roosevelt attended. Mark Twain spoke. And when the president of the National League declared that patriotism and research had shown that baseball was a purely American invention, guests and players alike chanted, "No rounders, no rounders." In the end, Spalding lost money on the tour, and baseball failed to catch on anywhere his teams had played.
A photo of Spalding in the middle of his Chicago team fades to black. A title, Heroes. Now, in front of a brick schoolhouse, little boys play on a tiny lot while their friends and teacher look on.
On many a summer day, I played baseball starting at 8 a.m, running home at noon for a quick meal, and again with fielding and batting till it was too dark to see the ball. These were times when my head seemed empty of everything but baseball names and figures. I could name the players who led in batting and fielding, and the pitchers who had won the most games. And I had my opinions about who was better than anybody else in the national game. Carl Sandburg.
A pair of old baseball cards, Boston's Kelly and Anson of Chicago.
By the 1880s, newspapers and magazines and now baseball cards, printed up to help boost the sale of cigarettes, brought into the homes of young boys a generation of baseball heroes they would never get to see in person. Pete Browning, the old gladiator of the Louisville Eclipse, had a lifetime batting average of .343 and was the idol of Kentucky fans. One day in 1884, he broke his favorite bat. After the game, an apprentice woodworker named Bud Hillerick offered to make Browning a new bat. The next day, Browning went 3 for 3. Thereafter, he would use no one else's bats. It was the first Louisville slugger, and Browning would eventually own more than 200 of them, to each of which he gave a name taken from the Bible. Roger Connor of the New York Giants was the era's greatest home run hitter. He smashed 138 during his career, a record which would stand until Babe Ruth came along.
Now, a clean-shaven, plain-faced young man wearing a baggy black suit.
Denton True Young was an ungainly, out-of-place farm boy when he came to the Cleveland Spiders in 1890. Even his teammates took to calling him Cy, short for Cyrus, because he seemed so countrified. But Cy Young held the Chicago White Stockings to just 3 hits to win his first game, and then went on to win 510 more before he was through, a record never even approached by any other pitcher. Cy came to stand for Cyclone.
Grimacing, an older, bulkier Young extends his right arm in mid-pitch.
Mike Kelly was the trickiest player who ever handled a baseball. There was nothing he would not attempt. Baseball rules were never made for Kell.
The most popular and most notorious star of the 19th century was Michael Joseph King Kelly, the sure-handed catcher for the Chicago White Stockings. He was so skilled at stealing bases, he once stole 6 in a single game, that he inspired a popular song, "Slide, Kelly, Slide." He sometimes cut across the diamond, skipping second altogether when the umpire was not looking. Kelly drank as hard as he competed. Once, A.G. Spalding put Pinkerton detectives on his trail and accused him of having been in a saloon at 3 a.m. drinking lemonade. Kelly was indignant. "It was straight whiskey," he said. "I never drank a lemonade at that hour in my life." Kelly and other carousing Chicago players were widely blamed for losing the championship to St. Louis in 1886.
The mustached Kelly in Boston uniform.
That winter, an exasperated Spalding sold Kelly to Boston for the unheard-of sum of $10,000. Chicago fans were devastated, but Boston fans were so delighted they presented their new star with a house and a carriage drawn by two white horses in which to ride to the ballpark.
John Thorne.
I love King Kelly. I just love King Kelly. It's one of the great stories, my favorite. Is a day when he was sitting on the bench. And the rule at that time was that if you wanted to substitute for a player, all you had to do was announce yourself. So a foul ball comes in the direction of the bench. Kelly stands up, yells out, "Kelly now catching for Boston." Catches the ball, and it's reported as an out. This is the trickster. This is the villain. This is the fool. He is also a great, great player. He is all the wonderful archetypes of baseball wrapped into one. And he also managed to drink himself to death before he hit the age of 40. So that's also an archetype, alas, in baseball.
A curly-haired young athletics player.
I was a natural-born kicker, bent upon making trouble for others. I had an instinctive dislike both to study and work, and I shirked them whenever the opportunity offered. Cap Anson.
His real name was Adrian Constantine Anson. But those who cheered him for 27 years knew him first as Baby, then as Cap, and finally as Pop. He was the greatest player of his century. Anson played every position but pitcher for the Philadelphia Athletics, then joined Spalding's Chicago White Stockings and became first baseman and captain. He batted over 300 for 20 consecutive seasons, drove in 1,700 runs, and was the first man ever to accumulate 3,000 hits. Chicago fans loved Anson, but his players did not. He was too stern a taskmaster for that, imposing bed checks, levying $100 fines for beer drinking, insisting they report for a new early season workout he called spring training. But they admired him for the skills he taught them and his overwhelming determination to win. Cap Anson was the symbol, one writer said, of all that was strong and good in baseball.
An older, thin-haired Anson stares out sternly from a Chicago team picture. A new title reads, "My Skin is Against Me." Now, an all-black team poses in front of a painted forest backdrop.
If anywhere in this world the social barriers are broken down, it is on the ball field. There, many men of low birth and poor breeding are the idols of the rich and cultured. The best man is he who plays best. In view of these facts, the objection to colored men is ridiculous. If social distinctions are to be made, half the players in the country will be shut out. Better make character and personal habits the test. Newark Call.
Black laborers in a field.
African Americans, freed from slavery by the Civil War and filled with hope for a better future in freedom, soon found themselves prisoners again of white prejudice in the North and of Jim Crow laws in the South that segregated every aspect of their lives. Even games of baseball at an orphanage.
A solid brick wall divides a playground.
But freed blacks formed their own baseball clubs in cities north and south. One of Frederick Douglass's sons played for a team in Washington, D.C. And more than 50 blacks played professional baseball alongside whites during the 1870s and 80s. But it was never easy.
A team with a single black player.
Ball players do not burn with the desire to have colored men on the team. It is, in fact, the deep-seated objection to Afro-Americans that gave rise to the feet-first slide. The Buffaloes had a Negro for second base. He was a few shades blacker than a raven, but was one of the best players in the Eastern League. The players of the opposing team made it a point to spite this brunette Buffalo. They would tarry at second when they might easily make third, just to toy with the sensitive shins of the second baseman. The poor man played only 2 games out of 5. The rest of the time he was on crutches. Sporting life.
In 1884, the son of a black Ohio clergyman, Moses Fleetwood Walker, became the first African-American to make it all the way to the majors. Walker joined the Toledo Blue Stockings of the American Association as a catcher and immediately ran into a wall of bigotry. The Irish pitcher, Tony Mullane, ignored Walker's signals because he said he wouldn't take orders from a black man. Cap Anson himself tried to have Walker ejected from an exhibition game, threatening not to play if they didn't get that nigger off the field. Anson only backed down when he realized he'd forfeit his pay if he really did walk out. At one game, the Toledo manager received a letter said to be from 75 determined men who threatened to mob Fleet Walker if he dared make an appearance. Walker kept playing. His brother, Welday, joined the team for a time.
A black player in an Adrian uniform sits with white teammates.
1887 signaled the beginning of the end for black Americans in organized white baseball. When it seemed likely that the New York Giants would hire the black pitcher, George Stovey, Cap Anson made it clear that neither he nor any of his white stockings would ever play a team on which blacks were welcome.
Just why Adrian C. Anson was so strongly opposed to colored players on white teams cannot be explained. His repugnant feeling toward colored ball players and his opposition with his great power and popularity in baseball circles hastened the exclusion of the black man from the white leagues. Sol White.
Rather than face a revolt by Anson and other white players, the National League owners made a gentleman's agreement to sign no more blacks. The minor leagues followed suit, formally declaring that black players would no longer be welcome. Almost overnight, Moses Fleetwood Walker and all the other black players disappeared from organized white baseball. A few years later, the United States Supreme Court itself would rule that racial segregation was legal everywhere. It would be 60 years before another black man played in the major leagues.
If I had not been quite so black, I might have caught on as a Spaniard or something of that kind. My skin is against me. Bud Fowler.
A black bat boy smiles shyly at the camera. Buck O'Neill, Kansas City Monarchs.
You see a guy hit the ball out of the ballpark, a grand slam home run to win a baseball game. See? And that same guy can come up tomorrow in that situation and miss the ball and lose the ball game. It can bring you up here, and don't get too damn cocky, because tomorrow it can bring you down there. See? But one thing about it, though, you know it always will be a tomorrow. You got me today, but I'm coming back.
Now, a village green lined with white colonial houses. Players take the field as a few hundred spectators look on.
Baseball is good, an honorable profession, a great challenge. It has blessed me, I blessed it, and it has blessed our country. Branch Rickey.
The blonde Rickey as a little boy.
He was born on an Ohio farm in 1881 and named Wesley Branch Rickey for John Wesley, the founder of his family's Methodist faith. He was a pious, hard-working boy who memorized scripture, taught himself Greek, Latin, and algebra, and promised his mother never to drink or swear or violate the Sabbath. But he was mad about baseball, learned to play in the backyard with a ball stitched by his mother, followed every move of the Cincinnati Reds, and became a good enough catcher with the Duck Run Ohio team to consider a professional career.
Still, the game was not a proper livelihood for a God-fearing young man. And so, he abandoned baseball to teach school for $40 a month in Turkey Creek, Ohio.
Boys play outside a schoolhouse.
But Branch Rickey would one day become what one sports writer called the most original mind and the best organizer the game has ever produced. And in 1947, he would help make baseball, in truth, what it had always claimed to be, the national pastime.
Now, a mustached Detroit player catches a ball barehanded.
1889. If I cannot get my release, I must protect myself in another way. I'm over 40 and my fielding ain't so good, though I can still hit some. But I will say this, no man is going to sell my carcass unless I get half. Deacon White, Pittsburgh Alleghenies.
A new title reads, Dog Eat Dog. In a grainy photo, we scan a bench full of players, their backs to us. Some wear striped blazers over their white uniforms.
There was a time when the National League stood for integrity and fair dealing. Today, it stands for dollars and cents. Once it looked to the elevation of the game and an honest exhibition of the sport. Today, its eyes are on the turnstile. Players have been bought, sold, and exchanged as though they were sheep instead of American citizens. John Montgomery Ward.
In a striped jersey, Ward crosses his brawny arms.
New York Giants second baseman John Montgomery Ward was a rarity among players, a graduate of the Columbia Law School. And in an age when workers everywhere were struggling to win their rights, he was willing to take on the club owners on their own terms. Ward publicly denounced the reserve clause, which now kept every player from deciding for himself where he wished to play, and forced him to accept whatever wage his owner was willing to pay.
Ward hurls in a Brooklyn uniform.
There is now no escape for the player. If he attempts to elude the operation of the rule, he becomes at once a professional outlaw, and the hand of every club is against him. Like a fugitive slave law, the reserve clause denies him a harbor or a livelihood and carries him back bound and shackled to the club from which he attempted to escape. We have, then, the curious result of a contract which on its face is for 7 months, being binding for life. John Montgomery Ward.
A headline, the ballplayers meet.
At a meeting in New York City, Ward helped found the Brotherhood of Professional Baseball Players. It was the players' first attempt to organize, and they were determined to abolish the hated reserve clause.
A batter lunges at a pitch.
But Albert Goodwill Spaulding and the other owners would not give an inch. In 1889, they tried further to consolidate their power by setting an absolute salary cap of $2,500, then added insult to injury by charging the players rent for their uniforms. It was the last straw. With the help of several would-be owners, Ward and the Brotherhood started a rival league, the Players League.
A headline, Baseball Ward declared, the players have deserted the league. Now the bleachers of an open-air ballpark overflow with fans. With some sitting in horse-drawn buggies, they line up along the outfield to watch a game. In a two-story stadium, every seat appears filled.
At first, the new league did well. 56 top players defected to its teams and brought their fans with them.
Spalding's smooth, plump face is accented by a droopy mustache.
I am for war without quarter. I want to fight until one of us drops dead. From this point on, it will simply be a case of dog eat dog. And the dog with the bulldog tendencies will live the longest. Albert Goodwill Spaulding.
Spaulding fought back by mounting costly lawsuits, lowering ticket prices, scheduling games to coincide with the Players League, and by threatening to blacklist any man who dared play for the enemy.
while simultaneously trying to lure the new league's biggest stars back with bribes. King Kelly turned down $10,000. "I need the money," he told Spalding, "but I can't go back on the boys." The Players League defiantly held out. But three big leagues, the National League, the Players League, and the old Beer and Whiskey League, simply proved too many. Attendance dipped dangerously low for everyone. Finally, despite his own precarious financial position, Spalding made one last gamble. Feigning a self-confidence he did not feel, he demanded unconditional surrender. The Players League could not hold out any longer. By the end of the 1890 season, the league had lost more than $340,000, more than its investors could endure. The new league collapsed. John Montgomery Ward's Brotherhood was crushed, and the reserve clause remained firmly in place. The players were even more powerless than they had been before. Albert Goodwill Spalding's National League swallowed up both its rivals, and now, swollen to 12 teams, held a monopoly on Major League Baseball.
The Players League is deader than the proverbial doornail. When the spring comes and the grass is green upon the last resting place of anarchy, the national agreement will rise again in all its weight and restore to America, in all its purity, its national pastime, the great game of baseball. Albert Goodwill Spalding.
Two fielders, their movements blurred. One puts his hands on his hips. Now, billboards that read Guthrie Trunk Company, Colgan's Taffy, and Daniel Boone Cigars crowd the outfield of a ballpark. Writer Shelby Foote.
The great lesson in sports is supposed to be that you not only learn the elation of winning, but you learn how to lose. There's a lot of emphasis that in the British attitude towards sports, and Americans have it too, but there's something very American about being a poor loser, refusing to shake the other fellow's hand. He says he's a scoundrel, he always was a scoundrel, and he's even more than a scoundrel now that he's beat me. And there's something likable about that in people. It's bad sportsmanship.
A title reads, "The Toughest of the Tough." Now, in a Boston team photo, one player extends the middle finger of his left hand to the camera.
Baseball was mighty glamorous and exciting to me, but there's no use in blinking at the fact that at that time, the game was thought by solid, respectable people to be only one degree above grand larceny, arson, and mayhem. And those who engaged in it were beneath the notice of decent society. Connie Mack.
Editor Daniel Okrand.
The ballplayers, they were from the fringe of society. These were not educated men. These were not men who knew how to hold a cup of tea with just two fingers and stick out three. And the kind of game that they played suited the kind of people that they were.
Now, fans sit on crude bleachers.
Two teams dominated the 90s, the Boston Bean Eaters and the Baltimore Orioles. Boston, led by Billy Hamilton and Hugh Duffy, pioneered what would be called the inside game. But the Orioles perfected it. Sacrifice bunts, squeeze plays, double steals. They fought and struggled for every run.
They were mean, vicious, ready at any time to maim a rival player or an umpire if it helped their cause. The things they would say to an umpire were unbelievably vile. They broke the spirits of some very fine men. I've seen umpires bathe their feet by the hour after they spiked them through their shoes.
In an era of dirty baseball, the Orioles delighted in being the dirtiest. Managed by the outfielder Ned Hanlon, known as Foxy Ned, the Orioles were one of the greatest teams ever assembled. Dan Brouthers, the broad-shouldered first baseman, was the greatest power hitter of the 1880s, bettering 300 in 14 seasons.
Wee Willie Keeler in right field was the game's preeminent place hitter. Asked for the secret of his success, he answered, "Keep your eye clear and hit them where they ain't." He once managed at least one hit in 44 consecutive games. The shortstop was Huey Jennings, known for his distinctive yell as E-Yow. In 1896, he hit 401, stole 70 bases, and set a record in his specialty. He managed to get hit by pitched balls 49 times. Between seasons, he practiced law.
Daniel Okrent.
They were the ones who devised the famous Baltimore chop. They would intentionally hit down on the ball, hoping to get a large bounce, which would give the runner time to make it all the way to first base before the shortstop or second baseman could even field it. They would, opposing teams to combat this, would flood the area in front of home plate so that when they hit down for the Baltimore chop, the ball would just stop there, and the catcher would pick it up and throw the guy out at first. It was an entire set of strategies, tactics, and most importantly, attitudes, which I think that story reveals, that really defined baseball at the time.
A young, rail-thin player in a white roll-neck sweater holds out a bat and frowns with tightly closed lips.
The toughest of the toughs, and an abomination of the diamond. A rough, unruly man. He uses every low and contemptible method that his erratic brain can conceive to win a play by a dirty trick.
He was, in George Bernard Shaw's words, the one true American. When Shaw came to this country and he met McGraw, he said, "This is it. This is what America is about." He was a man who controlled his own destiny and attempted to control the destiny of anybody who came near him.
The most pugnacious Oriole of them all was the third baseman, John Joseph McGraw. McGraw was born in Truxton, New York, the first of eight children of an Irish immigrant railroad worker and his wife. He was a slight, eager 11-year-old whose proudest possession was his battered baseball, ordered from the Spalding catalog, when diphtheria struck his village in 1884. One by one, he watched as first his mother and then four of his brothers and sisters died. His father took out his grief and anger on his son, beating him so often and so mercilessly that at 12 he feared for his life and ran away from home.
McGraw, as a boy, his arms crossed defiantly.
He supported himself at odd jobs until he won himself a place on the Olean, New York professional team at 16, and never again willingly took orders from any man.
Young McGraw at third base was a tower of strength, but he spoiled his good work by acting like a rowdy. He's too hot-tempered to be allowed around without a guardian. These tough mugs who want to fight on all occasions should be chased out of the business.
He batted .321 or better over nine consecutive seasons and stole 436 bases. Although he was short and weighed barely 120 pounds, he tripped opposing runners on the base paths, blocked them, spiked them, and rarely complained when they did the same to him. "We'd spit tobacco juice on a spike wound," he remembered, "rub dirt in it, and get out there and play." Mayhem seemed to follow John McGraw wherever he went. When he got into a fist fight with the opposing third baseman in Boston in 1894, both benches emptied. Fans began brawling. Someone set the stands on fire. And the entire wooden ballpark and 170 neighborhood buildings went up in flames.
Black smoke billows from the stadium. Now an older McGraw in a Giants uniform.
John McGraw would stay in baseball for more than 40 years and become one of the game's greatest managers. But he never stopped fighting, never stopped savaging umpires, and was always willing to do just about anything to win.
He sits in front of the Giants' dugout.
The Orioles' combination of trickery, ferocity, and skill won them three National League pennants during the 1890s. Their rivals, the Boston Bean Eaters, took five. Baltimore and Boston were wildly successful.
but the two teams so overwhelmed their competition that baseball crowds dwindled dangerously for those clubs in other cities that never seemed to rise above 11th or 12th place. To many fans, the long season, one of the game's great strengths, now seemed pointless. Then a national depression cut further into profits, and the owners slashed players' salaries. Clergymen and the newspapers denounced the rowdyism and scandal that followed the game everywhere, and the owners seemed incapable of doing anything. By the end of the 19th century, the professional game was in trouble.
Players stop in mid-game, surrounded by deserted seats in a two-story stadium. Fade to black. A title appears, The Little Boys' Game. Now, surly-faced teenagers in short sleeves and suspenders pose for a team photo.
Laborers leave the shade and quiet of a shop for the sun and fury of a ball ground. They stand and they exercise for hours. They attest that they mean to be men and not machines.
Families picnic outside the lines of a makeshift diamond carved into a field.
Athletic games carry men back to their days of childhood. There is indeed, morally, a home base in all of them, as there is, literally, in baseball.
Writer Robert Creamer.
My grandfather was a sour old man, and I liked him. He lived with us. But he was out in the backyard throwing a ball when I was a little kid. He's smoking his pipe, and he said, you like baseball? And I said, yeah. He said, what do you play? And I said, I'm a shortstop. And he said, that's what I used to play. And I said, you used to play?
A young man in a uniform with quilted pants.
And about, a year or so later, I found the local paper did a 50-year anniversary thing, and there was a reprint of a game that he had played in 1892, and it said Watts. His name was Fred Watts, shortstop, and he had two hits. And I thought, my grandfather played baseball in 1892. So it's part of existence. It's part of our heritage.
Actor Billy Crystal.
There's a very peaceful thing. It was created and played in pastures and meadows. There's grass, there's outdoors, there's everything that people thought was American and feel about America. You get in a ballpark. And it's the wonder of holding your dad's hand, walking through that dark tunnel, and seeing a huge open space where men play the little boy's game.
Now, on a farm, two-wheeled carriages rest by a dirt lane. Five little boys improvise a game in a nearby field. The pitcher grins, ready to throw to his friend, who wears knickers and knee socks. A smaller boy wearing overalls with the pants rolled up to his knees stands close by, watching. The image fades to a photo of a Boston baseball club and the New York Giants posing side by side. A bat boy wearing a tiny New York uniform stands between two players. Broadcaster Bob Costas.
You think about it. What is there in your life, besides your love of family maybe, that carries all the way through from almost your earliest recollections till the day you die, and you care about it in one way or another? There are very, very few things that make that list. We come to things at various times in our lives when we can comprehend them, when we have an interest in them. But we have a child's interest in baseball, in my case, from the time I was five. I can't imagine never having an interest in baseball. So it will be one of the few things in my life that I have cared about in one way or another all the way through.
By 1900, Walt Whitman and Alexander Joy Cartwright and Harry Wright had died.
We glide over the crowded rooftops of Brooklyn.
Baseball had grown from a children's game to a brawling pastime for big city workers to an industry.
Our view focuses on a white church steeple.
And the names and deeds of its greatest heroes had become familiar in every American home.
Houses with neat, square lawns border a broad, tree-lined dirt avenue.
But now, jealousy and greed among the owners, who held a monopoly on Major League Baseball, threatened to destroy all that they had built. public was turning to other sports where the amateur spirit had not been lost. It would take a new generation of baseball players, stars who would come to represent the best and the worst of the new 20th century, to rescue the national pastime.
A boy in black knickers swings hard.
By 1900, Ty Cobb and Casey Stengel and George Herman Ruth had been born.
The scene fades to black. This film has been described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, WGBH, Boston. Described by Leslie Wu Foley. Descriptions read by Rena Baskin. Funding provided by the United States Department of Education and by General Motors. Credits appear. A film by Ken Burns. Produced by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. Written by Jeffrey C. Ward and Ken Burns. Supervising film editor, episode editor, Paul Barnes. Coordinating producers, Bruce Alfred and Mike Hill. Narrated by John Chancellor. Voices, Adam Arkin, Philip Bosco, Keith Carradine, David Caruso, Wendy Conquest, John Cusack, Ossie Davis, Lauren Dean, Julie Harris, Anthony Hopkins, Derek Jacobi, Gene Jones, Garrison Keillor, Delroy Lindo, Stephen Lang, Amy Madigan, Arthur Miller, Charlie McDowell, Gregory Peck, George Plimpton, Jason Robards, Paul Roebling, John Turturro, Studs Terkel, Eli Wallach, and Tom Wicker. Produced with the cooperation of the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Music recorded at Sound Design, Brattleboro, Vermont. Star Spangled Banner performed by Branford Marsalis and Bruce Hornsby. Take Me Out to the Ball Game, courtesy of Broadway Music Corporation. The Band Played On, courtesy of QRS Music Rolls, Incorporated. Old Rosin the Bow, performed by Peter Basquin, courtesy of New World Records. The First Baseball Game, written by Don Ray and Gene DePaul, published by the Hub Music Company and Big Four Music Publishing Company. Farewell My Home, written and performed by Tony Ellis, published by Mary Wang, Incorporated, courtesy of Flying Fish Records. Archival material, the National Baseball Library and Archive, Cooperstown, New York. The Sporting News, the Babe Ruth Museum, Boston Public Library, the Bostonian Society, Brooklyn Public Library, George Eastman House, Harvard University Archives, Library of Congress, Los Angeles Dodgers, Incorporated, Louisville Slugger Company, Mount Holyoke College, New York Historical Society, New York Public Library, Princeton University, Spalding Sports Worldwide, Vassar College, Suzanne Spalding Winston, and others. Produced in association with WETA-TV, Washington. Sharon Rockefeller, President. Project Director for WETA, Tamara Robinson. A production of Florentine Films. Executive Producer, Ken Burns. Copyright 1994, The Baseball Film Project, Incorporated. All rights reserved.